Hello and welcome to Crime Monthly presents Evil Uncovered, where each week we explore the twisted minds and terrifying acts of those who chose to walk the path of darkness. In this episode, we delve into the chilling world of cult leaders, where charisma and a thirst for power transform into deadly manipulation. From the outside, they seemed like saviors, promising salvation, purpose, and community. But behind the facade lay darker intentions. So join us as we uncover the stories of three monstrous messiahs whose twisted visions led their followers down a path of terror and tragedy. Listener discretion is advised. Our first story takes us to the quiet town of Kirtland, Ohio. Nestled in America's heartland, it's a town steeped in history, known for its ties to the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or the RLDS. But in the 1980s, this peaceful community became the stage for one of the most horrifying acts in American history, a descent into madness and murder that would seal the horrifying legacy of a cult leader and his devoted followers. On April the 17th, 1989, a chilling darkness enveloped the isolated farmhouse home of Jeffrey Lundgren as an unsuspecting family were invited over by a man they trusted as their spiritual guide. But Dennis Avery, his wife Cheryl, and their daughters Trina, Rebecca, and Karen could have no idea of the sinister fate awaiting them after unwittingly crossing Lundgren, one of his followers would later say.
"We were simply following orders. Jeffrey said it was a blood sacrifice, something that had to be done for the greater good of the cult. We had no choice but to obey."
What unfolded that night was an astonishing act of evil. But who was Lundgren, and what made him so powerful that others were willing to kill for him? Jeffrey Lundgren's story began in Mississippi, where he was born in 1950. Raised in the RLDS, his early years were marked by his father's harsh discipline. Jeffrey often found himself isolated, spending most of his time alone, but those who knew him as a child described him as arrogant, a trait that followed him into adulthood. He carried an air of superiority and had a penchant for quoting long passages from the Bible.
"Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways submit to him, and he will make your paths straight."
As he grew older, Lundgren attended Central Missouri State University, where he met Alice Keeler, a fellow RLDS member. They married in 1970 when Alice became pregnant. Soon after, Lundgren joined the Navy and served during the Vietnam War. After his honorable discharge in 1974, Lundgren struggled to hold down a job. His financial instability led him to steal from his employers, marking the beginning of a descent into criminal behavior. At home, Lundgren's darker tendencies also grew more pronounced. He became increasingly abusive towards Alice, both physically and psychologically, manipulating her into believing he was a prophet chosen by God.
"He told me God had chosen him and I had to obey his every command. I didn't know what to believe anymore."
Over the next decade, the couple had four children together, but the cycle of abuse continued, escalating to the point where Alice was hospitalized with a ruptured spleen, a harrowing testament to the violence that lurked behind closed doors. In 1984, Lundgren uprooted the family from Missouri to Kirtland. It was a move driven by his apparent religious devotion, as Kirtland was a historical center for the RLDS Church. There, they became involved with the Kirtland Temple, a revered site for the church's followers, and Lundgren's deep knowledge of scripture soon earned him a position as a temple guide. It was unpaid, but provided a home for his family. However, Lundgren's darker tendencies soon resurfaced, and he began embezzling funds, pocketing donations meant for the church. By 1987, he'd stolen an estimated $40,000, but rather than report him to the authorities, the church discreetly asked him to leave.
"We had no choice but to ask him to go. His actions were unacceptable. Jeffrey's betrayal of trust was something we never saw coming."
What no one realized was that Lundgren had been quietly cultivating his own following, setting the stage for the chilling events that would soon unfold. After leaving the temple, Lundgren had a new plan. He moved his family into the farmhouse that would soon become the epicenter of his own church. It was here that Lundgren began to solidify his control over his followers, drawing them into a world of manipulation and fear. Those who followed him from the temple left behind their previous lives, choosing instead to live under Lundgren's rule. The farmhouse became a commune, where daily life was dictated by Lundgren's whims and supposed divine messages. Followers would later say,
"We called Jeffrey Dad and handed over all of our earnings, even our lives, to him. It was all in the service of a greater good, or so we believed at the beginning."
Others relocated to the small Ohio town specifically to follow Lundgren. One such couple was Ron and Susan Luff, who believed they would be involved in local charity work. Susan would later say,
"We thought we were joining a community of artists, a place to do good. We expected we'd be helping the hungry and the poor. Of course, none of that happened. What did happen was we were made to do hard labor, and the women had to dance naked while Lundgren watched."
In order to exert ever more control, Lundgren began pretending he was receiving messages from a higher power and could read his followers' minds. In fact, he was simply eavesdropping on them. Evenings would be spent listening to Lundgren quote scripture, but it was clear something wasn't right. The supposedly devout Lundgren had taken to carrying a gun and wearing camouflage gear. However, the arrival of the Avery family marked a turning point.
Dennis, Cheryl, and their girls, 15-year-old Trina, 13-year-old Rebecca, and 7-year-old Karen, struggled to fit in right from the start. They chose to live in their own home, something Jeffrey decided was sinful, and their complete refusal to accept his teachings that women were subservient to men just made him even angrier.
As Lundgren's grip over the rest of his followers tightened, his messages grew more extreme. His mind was now set on a violent takeover of the Kirtland Temple that had rejected him. He believed that by seizing control of the temple, he could usher in the second coming of Christ. His followers, now a fully fledged cult, were swept up in his apocalyptic visions as they were told they must prune the vineyard, a chilling euphemism for murder. Lundgren initiated combat training, preparing them for violence, and as the men learned to wield knives and guns, the stage was set for a horrific act.
"He spoke of God's commands of visions that demanded blood. We were to storm the temple, to kill for the promised land."
Mercifully, the plan to storm the temple was thwarted after local police were tipped off by concerned community members and intervened, preventing what could have been a massacre. Though they lacked the evidence to make arrests, their presence was enough to force Lundgren to abandon his scheme. He told his followers it was God's will and turned his attention back towards his own community. He began exerting an even tighter grip, and anyone who didn't agree with everything he said would be singled out for intimidation. But his main problem was the Avery family. They were the only ones not handing over their life savings, as well as continuing to live apart from Lundgren and his followers.
"The Averys were different. They didn't bow to him, and that made them targets."
Lundgren also resented the fact the women were strong-minded, saying dismissively that Cheryl wore the pants. So, when his mind went back to finding the promised land, he decided he needed to move his followers off-grid, but not everyone was going to be welcome. Lundgren was about to decree that they needed to offer a blood sacrifice, and the ones chosen to die were the Avery family. On April the 17th, 1989, Lundgren's deadly plan was set into motion. The Averys were invited to the farmhouse under the guise of fellowship, but what awaited them was a nightmare. As the women engaged Cheryl and the girls in conversation, Dennis was quietly led away to a nearby barn by the men. What was once a simple storage space for hay and equipment had been transformed into a chamber of horrors. Inside that barn, Dennis came face to face with a haunting sight, a gaping 7-foot hole that he must have realized would soon become his grave. In that dark place, Lundgren's son, Damon, along with cult members Richard Brand, Ron Luff, Gregory Winship, and Daniel Kraft, set upon Dennis. They tied him up and gagged him with duct tape, leaving him unable to plead for his life or the lives of his family. Then, in a cold and calculated act, Lundgren stood over Dennis and shot him twice in the back. But the horror didn't stop there. Next, Cheryl was lured to the barn under the pretense that Dennis needed her. Stepping inside, she would have seen her husband's body on the floor and had a moment to register what it meant before meeting the same brutal fate, shot three times in the chest and stomach. Tragically, the Avery daughters were not spared. As the evening wore on, Trina, Rebecca and little Karen were each led to the barn, where Lundgren executed them with chilling precision. Trina was shot once in the head and twice in the body, Rebecca in the back and thigh and Karen, just 7 years old, in the head and chest. One follower would later confess,
"I carried little Karen out there myself. When she rode on my shoulders, she thought it was all an adventure, a game. What happened was quick and it was brutal. There was no mercy."
In an astonishing twist, the police arrived the next day, responding to local concerns about a cult operating at the farmhouse. Tragically, Lundgren managed to convince them nothing was amiss, and the bodies of the Avery family lay undiscovered. This close encounter was enough to prompt Lundgren and his followers to flee to West Virginia. But Lundgren's days were numbered when he decided to make one of the followers his second wife. The move angered her husband, who tipped off law enforcement about the murders. In January 1990, police returned to the farmhouse and finally uncovered the bodies buried in the barn.
It was a gruesome scene, a whole family shot to death, including the kids. It was the kind of thing you never forget.
Lundgren and his followers were apprehended quickly, each facing charges related to the brutal slayings. Many accepted plea deals for reduced sentences, with Lundgren's son Damon receiving a sentence of 120 years, and Ronald Luff, one of Lundgren's most loyal followers, condemned to life without parole. However, the defiant Lundgren insisted on a trial. It fast became a spectacle of arrogance as Lundgren claimed his actions had been divinely commanded. But the jury saw through his delusions, and on August the 29th he was found guilty of multiple counts of aggravated murder and kidnap, and sentenced to death. His chilling words echoed in the courtroom as he declared,
"I am not a false prophet, and therefore I am not worthy of the penalty sought by those who seek my death."
Lundgren would languish in jail until October the 24th, 2006. That day, he succumbed to the ultimate in divine justice when he was executed by lethal injection, aged 56, marking the end of the notorious story of the Kirtland killings. Our next story transports us to the heart of California's Central Valley and the city of Fresno, a place where sun-soaked fields and serene neighborhoods once hid dark secrets. In 2004, what began as a routine child custody dispute quickly spiraled when authorities encountered a man claiming to be a vampire messiah. What unfolded next was an act so horrific, it would leave a permanent scar on the community and haunt the memories of all who witnessed it. On March the 12th, police officers arrived at 761 West Hammond Avenue, where a man named Marcus Wesson had barricaded himself inside the apartment with his children, while his estranged wife stood anxiously outside. For two agonizing hours, the police desperately tried to persuade him to release the children. Then the sound of gunshots rang out. As the echoes of gunfire faded, Wesson emerged from the apartment, his clothes stained with blood. The officers moved in quickly, and what they discovered inside was a scene of unimaginable horror, as nine bodies lay entwined in a heap, surrounded by 12 coffins, a chilling embodiment of his vampiric beliefs. But how did Marcus Wesson lead his family to such a tragic end? Wesson was born in 1946, amid a home of abuse and instability. His mother Carrie was a devout member of the Seventh-day Adventists, a faith she enforced with unwavering rigidity. Yet, it was his father, Ben, who cast the darkest shadow over Marcus's formative years. An abusive alcoholic, Ben's volatile behaviour left deep scars on the family. When Ben walked out, the betrayal left a lasting impact on Wesson. This abandonment, coupled with a severe stutter, isolated him from his peers, leaving him to navigate a world that seemed increasingly hostile. As he entered his teenage years, he began to question the teachings of the Seventh-day Adventists, and his growing disdain for the church foreshadowed the radical beliefs he would later adopt. At the age of 19, he enlisted in the US Army, serving as a medic during the Vietnam War. This period of his life was marked by chaos and trauma, experiences that would later shape his distorted worldview. When he left, Wesson met Rosemary Solorio, a woman 14 years his senior, who had six children of her own. Wesson, then just 21, moved in with Rosemary and quickly assumed the role of head of the household. It was here that the seeds of his cult were sown. Like his mother before him, Wesson wielded religion as a tool of control, twisting it to fit his own warped ideology. His teachings, a bizarre blend of apocalyptic prophecy and polygamous doctrine, ensnared his new family in a web of fear and obedience. Rosemary was naively captivated by Wesson's charisma and was soon drawn into his delusions, believing in his self-proclaimed divine status. In 1971, when Wesson was 25 and Rosemary 37, the couple welcomed their first child together. By this time, Wesson held such an iron grip on the family, they believed every action he took was ordained by God. But Wesson was about to set in motion the next phase of his ascent into the spiritual life he believed he was created for. In 1973, he withdrew his affection from Rosemary, telling her that God had chosen a new matriarch of the family, and it wasn't her. Instead, it was her 14-year-old daughter Elizabeth he was going to marry, an expert would say.
Rosemary had no idea Elizabeth was already pregnant with Wesson's child and had been abused by him for years. Wesson told Elizabeth when she was just 8 that she belonged to him and that he was already her husband. When Elizabeth was 15, she was forced to marry her common-law stepfather.
By the time Elizabeth was 26, she had given birth to 11 children. Not wanting any more, she asked Wesson if she could be sterilized and was shocked when he agreed. She didn't yet realize Wesson had stayed steadfast in his belief that, as the ultimate leader of his kingdom, he deserved to live a polygamous life. When their daughter Kiani got pregnant at 18, Elizabeth was horrified to find out the father was Wesson. And there was more horror to come as he told her.
The Lord wants me to carry on having lots of children. He wants me to impregnate our kids.
Subject to frequent abuse as part of his teachings, Wesson told his family members the apocalypse was coming and that he was God's final prophet. Central to his warped teachings was the idea that Jesus was a vampire who allowed his apostles to drink his blood. Wesson said he'd been chosen as one of Jesus' last vampires and would lead the family to paradise on Christ's return to earth. His beliefs ran so deep, he was said to have encouraged his family to drink each other's blood as a form of spiritual ritual. Marcus Wesson created an environment where his word was law and dissent was unthinkable. This descent into darkness set the stage for the horrific events that would later unfold as Wesson's delusions of grandeur and control continued to spiral. The family lived a nomadic lifestyle, frequently drifting from place to place, often in squalor and surviving on welfare. Wesson rarely let the children leave the home, although when he ate at restaurants, he'd send them out to scavenge for food in bins. Over the years, Wesson would marry his nieces Rosa and Sophina, as well as molesting his niece Ruby and his own daughters. When Ruby got pregnant at 13, her cousin Sophina was also expecting. Eventually, the women managed to escape from Wesson's clutches, but when they fled his home, they were forced to leave their children with their father. In 2003, Wesson moved the remaining family to that apartment in Fresno, but when he prepared to move yet again, Rosa and Sophina decided to go and get their children back.
In local news, Fresno has been rocked by a mass shooting following what authorities described as a custody dispute. It's been reported police were called after two women arrived at an apartment on West Hammond Avenue, demanding the man inside, identified as 57-year-old Marcus Wesson, return their children to them. Wesson locked himself inside, and after a two-hour standoff reappeared, asking the police to wait at the door before going back inside. It was then that the sound of gunshots was heard. Wesson allowed police to place him in custody, and when officers gained entry, they found nine victims, each one reportedly shot once through the eye.
It was an almost incomprehensible sight, and police would later say,
"This wasn't just a crime scene. It was the tragic culmination of years of manipulation and abuse. The victims were Wesson's flesh and blood, ranging in age from 25 to just 1 year old. Wesson had prepared his whole family for suicide, instructing them to take their own and each other's lives if the police ever caught up with him."
The massacre shook the nation, leaving a community in despair and a country wrestling with the horror of it all. As the investigation unfolded, surviving children began to share their harrowing experiences under Wesson's control. They described a life dominated by fear and manipulation, drawing chilling comparisons between Wesson and infamous cult leaders such as David Koresh and Jim Jones. Wesson went on trial in June 2005, charged with murdering nine family members and engaging in acts of sexual abuse and incest. The defense claimed it was in fact Wesson's eldest daughter who killed the children before taking her own life. But while evidence did seem to at least partially support that claim, the prosecution argued that Wesson had orchestrated the entire tragedy, using his influence to drive his family to their deaths. Eventually, a verdict was reached, and news reports would say,
"After 3 months of harrowing testimony, Marcus Wesson was today convicted of 9 counts of murder and 14 counts of rape. He has been sentenced to death, a verdict that will perhaps bring a semblance of closure to the victims' families and a community that has been left shattered by his crimes."
Today, 77-year-old Marcus Wesson remains on death row in San Quentin State Prison. The families of the victims continue to grapple with the loss of their loved ones, while the community struggles to heal from the scars left by the horrific events. The murder house was demolished, but the empty lot remains, a haunting reminder of the tragedy that took so many innocent lives.
Crime Monthly magazine is dedicated to all things true crime, where you'll find all the latest news, in-depth features, interviews with leading experts, and so much more. We've even got your essential entertainment guide for the month ahead. Buy in all good shops and supermarkets or subscribe now at greatmagazines.co.uk.
Our final story takes us far from California to the rolling hills of New South Wales, Australia. Nestled in a secluded settlement near the coastal town of Bega, surrounded by dense forests and far from the public eye, sat the headquarters of a controversial New Age group known as the Great White Brotherhood. But the serene landscape belied the dark practices within, and as the sun rose on the morning of August the 14th, 1987, armed police stormed the premises. Their mission was clear: to rescue 28 children from the clutches of a woman who'd convinced her followers she was the reincarnation of Christ. Her name was Anne Hamilton Byrne, and to her devoted followers, she was a messiah. But to the outside world, she was the leader of a cult otherwise known as the Family, a group founded on manipulation, torture, and abuse. Before Hamilton Byrne became the figurehead of the notorious sect, she was Evelyn Grace Victoria Edwards, born into a life of poverty and chaos in December 1921. The first of seven children born to Ralph and Florence, her father first left home when Anne was 3 years old, and he was in and out of his children's lives for years, creating an unstable atmosphere. Florence claimed she was a medium who could communicate with the dead, and tried to convince the community in their small town of her gift. Many believed her and would pay for her services, but after she set her hair alight in the street, she was diagnosed as schizophrenic and sent to a psychiatric hospital. Evelyn was just 20 when her mother was first committed, a witness to the turmoil that mental illness wrought on her family. Florence's life became a series of moves from one institution to another, a tragic cycle that ended with her death in a hospital. These experiences left a profound mark on Evelyn, fueling her desire for reinvention. By 1941, Evelyn had undergone numerous cosmetic surgeries and changed her name to Anne Hamilton. She married a farmer named Lionel Harris, and together they dreamt of adopting a baby. But fate was to deal her a cruel hand. Just before the adoption was finalised, Lionel was killed in a car accident. Anne's hopes of a new beginning were shattered in an instant, and losing both her husband and her dream of a baby was something she'd never recover from. Alone and seeking solace, she turned to yoga, a practice that was gaining popularity at the time. She found peace and a sense of community in its teachings, eventually becoming an instructor herself. Her classes, a blend of yoga and philosophical teachings, attracted the wives of wealthy professionals, women who were searching for guidance and belonging. A psychiatrist would say,
Anne's charisma and ability to draw people in became evident as she led the classes. She offered spiritual guidance to women whose lives were in turmoil, and they, in turn, became her devoted followers. But beneath the surface, Anne's need for control and fear of abandonment were brewing into something far more sinister.
Anne began convincing many of the vulnerable suburban housewives in her groups to divorce their husbands, leaving them with only Anne to turn to. She was building up her cult, and her talent for manipulation was about to help her get what she desired more than anything else, children. But she needed to expand her small yoga family, and for that she needed powerful allies who could help her. In 1962, respected academic Dr. Rainer Johnson became her target as she decided that, with his help, she would be able to legitimise her group and gain influence with respected professionals. She slept with his gardener to get personal information about him, information she used to convince him she was a clairvoyant. One day, Anne knocked on his front door and told him she knew he was going to India and that his wife was going to get sick. Both turned out to be true, and from then on, he believed she was the Messiah. She continued to feed him lies, including convoluted tales about her past, and told him that she wanted to give him eternal life. He was hooked. With Dr. Johnson's endorsement, Anne's influence grew, and by 1968, she had amassed a following of 500, including lawyers who could defend her in court and forge passports, doctors and nurses who gave Anne access to elderly people who would surrender their fortunes to her, and judges who would sentence anyone who threatened them. Rainer was an invaluable asset, but she'd also made another union that was to prove essential. Dr. Howard Whittaker worked at a private psychiatric hospital that used psychedelic drugs to treat patients, specifically the potent hallucinogen LSD. Anne was able to lure Whittaker into getting her illegal prescriptions, which she used in initiations she called clearings. Every new member would be put into a room and injected with LSD, then left. After a few hours alone, Anne would appear in a doorway wearing a white gown and convince them they were seeing Jesus Christ. By now, over a quarter of the sect was made up of doctors, nurses, and other medical professionals, and Anne began using them to set in motion her plan to achieve her ultimate dream of motherhood. But she wouldn't be getting pregnant herself or even adopting. Instead, she began stealing newborns. The first child she took was Sarah Moore, and the circumstances were chilling. As soon as Sarah was born, a pillow was placed over her biological mother's head, and she was injected with tranquilizers. The young mother, just 16 years old, was left powerless as her child was taken right out of her arms. The doctor who delivered Sarah was Rainer Johnson's daughter, a loyal member of the family. Sarah would later say,
I grew up believing Anne was my mother. It wasn't until I was a teenager that I discovered the horrifying truth that I had been stolen the moment I was born.
Over the years, Anne acquired more children through manipulative tactics. The cult's lawyers played a key role, forging documents to give the children new identities. Some social workers within the cult bypassed legal adoption routes, while other women were coerced into giving up their children in exchange for Anne's so-called miracles. She would enlist corrupt doctors to poison family members who had a young child, then offer to cure them in exchange for giving up the child. When the woman agreed, Anne would order the doctors to stop the poisoning, and she'd recover. By 1971, Anne had seven children, all aged three and under, who all believed they were siblings. That year, Anne moved them all to Uptop, a secluded house nestled in the woods, and other family members bought property in and around the area. With the advent of nuclear weapons, the members wanted to stay close to their leader for fear of the apocalypse.
Anne told us the world could end at any moment, and she said that while the rest of society would be annihilated, we'd all survive. We were told her children were perfect children who would save the world, and Anne was securing what she called the white master race, giving them all identical clothes and haircuts.
In 1974, Anne set up a school, but by then her interest in being a mother was waning. The children craved her affection, believing she was their real mum, but she left their care to three women from the group that they called aunties. These women enforced a military-style regime, waking the children at 5:30 for yoga meditation, followed by schooling. The children were punished for any deviation from the regime, and beatings and torture were common. In one harrowing incident, a family member who had come to teach the children art noticed his brushes were missing. When he informed the aunties, they gathered the children together, filled a bucket of water, and dunked their heads under. The children were brought to the brink of drowning for hours. An expert would say,
Anne seemed to take a true sadistic pleasure in the torture, asking the aunties to hold the phone so she could hear the kids scream as they were beaten. It was a deeply concerning personality trait.
In the mid-1970s, the cult built a temple across the road from Rainer Johnson's home. There, they would meet on Sundays and Thursdays for LSD-fueled sermons. They also began giving the children LSD, injecting them and locking them in a room for hours. One screamed so loudly during the ordeal, neighbours across the lake called police. The charismatic Anne welcomed the officers in and served them tea as the children were stuffed into a crawl space covered with plywood. The children were kept in the hole until the police left. They were too afraid to scream for help. It was far from the first time the authorities had been called, but Anne had taught the children how to answer difficult questions. The children were also starved. They were weighed regularly, and if deemed too heavy, Anne would withhold food. As a result, the children would make themselves sick to reduce their weight. However, some were beginning to rebel. Sarah had found a way into the auntie's room and began making herself toast whenever she could. She was discovered when she wiped the butter knife on a towel and was brutally beaten and thrown down a flight of stairs. But she was getting older and more defiant. She began to take long walks and one night came across a house with a window open. She crept in and stole all the food she could, stashing it in the woods. She then began leading her brothers and sisters out at night to break into nearby homes and find food. The starving, miserable and scared children were beginning to deviate from Anne's torturous regime, and the beginning of the end was coming. In 1978, Anne married William Bill Byrne, a rich former RAF officer. Anne had amassed a fortune herself and decided she no longer needed to convince people she was the Messiah. Having obtained everything she wanted, she was nearing the end of one of the longest cons ever played. But a few years later, she did something that would become her unravelling. She allowed daughters Sarah and Leanne to make friends outside the community. Kathy and Helen were teenage sisters Sarah and Leanne went to school with, and they were not shy about telling their friends of their unhappy existence, referring to themselves as POAs or prisoners of Anne. One night, Kathy and Helen's mother Erica drove the girls home, and Sarah invited her into Uptop. When Anne learned what Sarah had done, she threw Sarah out of the family, telling her,
"You are no longer our daughter. Go and die in the gutter."
Sarah went to live with Kathy and Helen, and after divulging stories about her upbringing, Erica took her to the police. State and federal police raided Uptop on the 14th of August, as well as mounting coordinated raids on other family properties, and found huge stashes of drugs. But Anne was nowhere to be found. She had already fled to the United States, leaving behind a crumbling empire. And while Dr. Howard Whitaker's practice was disgraced and Rayner was blacklisted, nobody was prosecuted for the myriad abuses the family had perpetrated. It wasn't until June 1993 that Anne and her husband Bill were extradited back to Australia to face charges of conspiracy to defraud and perjury. Yet, the charges were dropped, and they only faced minor penalties for making a false declaration. A mere $5,000 fine each was all they paid before walking free. Anne Hamilton Byrne's reign of terror ended with her death in June 2019. She left behind a fortune of $10 million, a testament to her ability to manipulate and control. But she also left a legacy of trauma for the children she claimed to save. As with the other stories in this episode, it is a haunting reminder of how fragile the human mind can be and how easily it can be bent to the will of evil. That's all from this week's episode. Thank you for joining us and be sure to tune in next time when we'll be bringing you three more tales of true life terror. Evil Uncovered is brought to you by Bauer Media. Concept and original stories by Steph Seelan and Lisa Howells. Episode written and exec produced by Lisa Howells. Produced and edited by Rick Simmons. AI voices produced and edited by Waldemar Matwash. Episode created with support from WeDaVinci AI Technology.